So, having spent the first two parshas of Bereishis dealing with matters global, we move now to all things national, as the story of the Chumash becomes the story of Avraham Avinu, and then the Jewish people. The parsha Lech Lecha opens with Avraham's famous journey to Eretz Canaan. Lech Lecha me'artzecha. Hashem tells Avram to go to Canaan. Now the truth is, as we know, but it's easy to forget, because placement is everything, there is a certain background to this journey of Avram to the land of Canaan, and from a certain point of view, the journey has already begun. In the end of last week's parsha, if we take a look at Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, it states, "Vayikach Terach es Avram beno." Terach takes Avram his son, ves Lot ben Haran ben beno, and Lot is his grandson, the son of Haran. Vesarai Kalosso, his daughter Nosara, Ishes Avram beno. Vayetzu itam meur kastim laleches arza Canaan. So they leave Ur Kastim with the goal of getting to Eretz Canaan. They reach Haran and they settle there. So that's very interesting and important to bear in mind. As if to say, the trip to the land of Canaan, seemingly taking the pasuk at face value, was instigated by Terach. He took Avram with him. So they're kind of on the way already. Now, having said that, if we look at Pasuk Lamed Beis, which more or less ends, encapsulates the life of Terach, by you may Terach, Chameshanim Masam Shana, Terach, his years were 205 years, Vayamas Terach Bacharan, he died in Charan. And the next thing we know after the Haftorah is that Hashem appears to Avram and tells him to go. And seemingly, we have a chronological sequence, all things being equal, the sequence is chronological. However, we know that that's not the case. Meaning, we know that the Terach did not die before Hashem told Avram to go to Canaan, or to keep going to Canaan. How so? Simple arithmetic. And the Torah wants us to know this because it tells us the numbers. In Pasuk Kafvav of Perek Yud Aleph, it states, Vayechi Terach, as we know, we have those 10 generations and all of the numbers, how old was he when he had him? Vayechi Terach, Shevim Shana, Terach was 70 years old, Vayolech es Avram, es Nachor, es Haran, presumably Avram first. So Terach is 70 when Avram is born. Avram, as our Pasuk tells us, is 75 when he's told to go to Canaan, which puts Terach at the age of 145. If he is 205 when he dies, that means that 60 years have yet to happen before Terach dies. And yet, the Torah tells us about this, and it sounds like he's died already, but he's still quite alive for a good 60 years. So what's behind the ordering here? And Rashi notes this question, and Rashi quotes from the Medrash, and there's many ways to understand really what the Medrash is saying, but one could almost sum up the approach of the Medrash by saying that Terach is essentially phased out of the equation. That means that Avram has no obligation to Terach to stay in Haran just because Terach is staying there for whatever reason. By mentioning the death of Terach here, he is basically fading as a concern in the equation here, and Avram is essentially meant to continue as if Terach is no longer alive, even though he is. But the Alshich has a somewhat different approach. And the Alshich asks an interesting shaila. We have a very interesting relationship with Terach. We're not quite sure what to make of him. He has his moments, but largely he's not considered to be one of the greatest tzaddikim. But he did set out to get to the land of Canaan. But it's also true that he didn't get there. And they came to Haran and they stayed there. So what type of a trip is that? What type of a journey to the land of Canaan if you only ever get halfway? And the Alshich says, and in contrast, of course, Avram having said that, buoyed by the message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but Avram does get to Canaan. That's an interesting shaila. If they all started in the same place, namely Ur Kasdim, how come Terach only got as far as Haran, but Avram made it all the way to the land of Canaan? And the Al-Sheikh says, when a person, or to understand the journey to Canaan, why one person completed it and the other one didn't, we need to understand why the journey was undertaken in the first place. If we look once again at Pasuk Lamed Aleph, it states, again, Vayikach Terach, Es Avram Beno, Besar Kaloso, Eshes Avram, etc. Vayetzu Itam Meur Kastim. So there's an important emphasis here. They went from Ur Kasdim. Lalechez Arza Kanaan. What's the goal? Or what's the point? The point is, says the Al-Sheikh, that if a person is in a difficult situation, a difficult location, things are very, they're very hard there, and then you have Eretz Kanaan, it's a possibility. Eretz Yisrael is a possibility. So the question is, When you go from A to B, what is your priority? Leaving A behind or getting to B? One could say, is a negative journey, and one is a positive journey. Now, that they're not in contradiction to each other, but when you see the priority, it may make a difference. As if to say, no one could stay in Ur Kasdim anymore. Things that heated up there, so to speak, and therefore, they have to leave. But when the Pasuk says, Vayetzu itom me'ur kastim, they all left Ur Kasdim, says the Al-Sheikh, it's emphasizing that the priority was to get out of Ur Kasdim. Now, when you're already leaving, im kvar, as they say, if you're already leaving, where better to go than the land of Israel? That may well be true. But because the focus is leaving where it's difficult and not necessarily getting to where it is the best, you might find yourself halfway there and stay there. In other words, and that's what the Pasuk says, Vayavo'u at Haran v'yeshusham. They came to Haran. Now, what does Haran have going for it? On the one hand, it's not the land of Canaan yet. But on the other hand, it's much better than Ur Kasdim. And therefore, if your motivation all the while was just to leave Ur Kasdim for a better place, and there is no better than Canaan, but Haran is not bad. And that's why Terach stayed there. And this really is the contrast between Terach's journey and Avram's journey. Because with Avram, the emphasis is not a negative one, but a positive one. His goal is not to get out of anywhere, it's to get to Eretz Canaan. As the Pasuk says in Pasuk Hey, in the beginning of our parsha, when Avram takes his people and goes, Vayikach Avram, Esar Ishto, Slot Ben Achiv, it's almost like a repetition in the sense of this, Eskor Ruchushim Asher Achashu, Ves HaNefesh Asher Asu Becharon, Vayetzu, and they left. But why did they leave? Laleches Eretz Kanaan. They left in order to get to Eretz Kanaan. And therefore the Pasuk concludes, Vayavo Eretz Kanaan. If a person leaves with the goal of getting to the Eretz Kanaan, he'll get there. If a person leaves with the goal of leaving a difficult place behind, he might not get there. Because he'll find an easier place, and it's halfway, and that's where he'll stay. And that says the Al-Sheikh in a rather somber comment. That's why Parshas Noach ends up by saying that Terach died in Haran, even though chronologically we know that that's not going to happen for 60 years. But the point is, says the Al-Sheikh, it's true, it won't happen for 60 years. But on the other hand, nothing will change in these 60 years. So you may as well say it now, because he's found Haran, and Haran is okay, and he can make a living, and it's good, and neighbors are nice. Which means where you see him now is where you can expect to see him 60 years' time, and that's where he passes away. And that's that. So that is his parshanut on the difference between the end of Parshas Noach Terach and the beginning of Lech Lecha. And therefore, from a certain point of view, it is correct to say that Avram was the first person to journey to Eretz Canaan, because he was the first person to journey there with the priority of actually getting there, as opposed to leaving somewhere else for the land of Canaan. So that's a certain perspective on Lech Lecha, and with that we move a little further into the parsha. Lech Lecha is just packed with so many things. In Perek Yud Dalet, the Torah devotes many psukim to a war, which then became a war and then a follow-up with the four kings and the five, you have these four people, and they begin to terrorize the region, and they wage war with the four, and one, and with the five, pardon me, and one of the five kings, of course, is the city of Sodom. In Sodom lives none other than Lot, and Lot gets captured, and that changes everything. As the Pasuk, we have the first dozen or so Pesukim of Perek Yud Dalet describe all of that. And then we have Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayavo ha-palit, the refugee comes. We'll find out who he is in just a moment. Vayaged la-Avram ha-Ivri, and he tells Avram, someone is a refugee, and he comes from the war zone to tell Avram what's happened. And the rest, as we know, is history. Avram hears about it, he gets his Talmidim together, and off they go and vanquish everyone. Who is this Palit? So interestingly, if we watch carefully, Rashi gives two Perushim, but the result is the same. Meaning the identity of this Palit is Oak. But Rashi says, you can explain this al derech ha-pshat and al derech ha-drash. But what does that mean? Og is a person, and the result is the same. Yes, but the difference where pshat and drash differ is, why is he called the palit? Why is he called? What is he remaining from? Says Rashi, on the pshat, he's the palit from the war. He's a refugee. That's what we're talking about here. And that's really what pshat deals with. Those are its tools, context, and etc. Al derech ha-drash, he's the palit because he's left over from the Mabul. He's left over from that whole time. Okay. It's very interesting that Rashi goes through these two possibilities, because at the end of the day, the identity where he's identified is the same person. He's Oak. He's just, where was he niflat from? Where is he coming from? From the war or from the Mabul? But he's here. Now, it's very interesting to track, and Og is really a minor character, he's not even mentioned by name in the Parsha, but this act had of coming to Avram to tell him about what happened in the war was to have reverberations generations to come. And where do we see that? We will meet Og again, actually, in a war. It's one of the wars that is described in Parshas Chukas. He was one of those between us and the land of Canaan, just as we were coming in. Sichon was first, Og was second, and that was that. And as the Pasuk says, he was conquered. But he put up a fight. And in fact, that battle has halachic implications. The Mishnah tells us, in the ninth parak of Maseches Brachos, there are certain places, special places, where miracles occurred for us. And if you see those places, you make a bracha. Baruch she'asa nisim labaseinu b'mokam hazeh. So for example, the Mishnah says, if you see the place where the Jewish people cross through the Yam Suf, make a bracha. Baruch she'asa nisim. If you can successfully identify where they cross through the Yam Suf, you'll probably make a fortune also. But in the meanwhile, assuming you know where it is, you make a bracha. And the Mishnah also says, if you see Even Shebikesh Og Melech HaBashan Lizrog Al Yisrael, if you see the rock that Og sought to throw or to hurl onto Bnei Yisrael as part of his war against them, you make a bracha. Because we were saved. That was a miracle to be saved from Og. Og is a force to be reckoned with. Again, how do you identify the rock? Hard to know. But the Gemara provides background. We won't go through every single aspect of the Gemara, but the ones that are germane to our discussion here. But the Gemara says that it describes the war in the following way. Og looks at the Jewish people, and he surveys their camp. How big is their camp? Their camp is what's called 3 parsa by 3 parsa, which for us is approximately 12 by 12 kilometers. That's a good encampment. So Og says, so what I'll do is I'll take a mountain that is essentially equal in size to that. I'll throw it on them, and that will be the end of them. And so he did, says the Gemara. He picks up this mountain. He's holding it over his head. But he got stuck. As the Gemara mentions, other aspects, ants came, ate through it, it falls on his head, it didn't work out for him as well as he thought he would, and he was not able to even put the mountain down. At that point, says the Gemara, Moshe enters the scene, and the Gemara describes Moshe in the following way. This is the death blow now to Og. Moshe was 10 amas tall, says the Gemara. He had an axe that was 10 amas long, and he jumped up 10 amas, which gives us a final elevation of 30 amas, and he hit Og in the ankle, and he killed him. And that was the end of Og Melech HaBashan. Now, as we can appreciate, there are a couple of questions here, perhaps more, but we'll limit ourselves to the questions that are relevant to where we are. Firstly, it's very interesting to note, and we shouldn't forget, it's very easy to get carried away in a story like this, but the first rule of Parshanut is thou shalt not get carried away. The Gemara says he lifted up a mountain that was equal in size to the camp of Bnei Yisrael, and that's what he's looking to throw on them. But let's not forget, this account of the Gemara is in elaboration of the ruling of the Mishnah, which says, Haroe Evan Shebikesh Og Melech HaBashan. If you see the rock that Og tried to throw on the Jewish people. Now, a rock is many things, but it's not a mountain. So why is how did it grow? Why is the Mishnah talking about an Evan, while the Gemara talks about a Har, and they're describing the same thing? That's the first thing. Secondly, if we take this uprooting of a mountain at face value, Og will end up being almost impossibly large. If we assume he's at least as big as that mountain, so he himself is a number of kilometers tall, it's very difficult for a number of reasons. At the very least, it is in conflict with what the Gemara says, seemingly, because the Gemara describes how Og survived the flood. He held on to the Teva. He held on to Noah's Ark, and that's how he was able to weather the flood, so to speak. Well, the Teva's 300 amas long. By this reckoning, Og is 24,000 amas long, which means he doesn't need the Teva, and probably the Teva doesn't need him also. They're not going to get much nachas from someone who's many, many times bigger than them. They're not going to give him buoyancy, and he doesn't need it. I mean, all things being equal, if he's that big, all he needs to do to survive the flood is just to sit down and make sure that he never falls asleep face downwards. But the Gemara says that, which means that we need to perhaps reconsider what we mean when we talk about him uprooting this mountain. Especially as, at the end of the day, the final coup for Moshe, he jumps up 30 amas, hits him in the ankle, and by the way, if he's 12 kilometers tall, 30 amas will not reach his ankle anyway, and then he kills him. So with all his size and with all his strength, he ends up being killed by a blow to the ankle, which is somewhat, I don't know, disappointing. Yeah, and historically, we note as well, the Achilles heel had not yet been invented. this entire account needs to be contemplated very, very carefully. And there are many explanations of it, but the classic explanation comes from the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, the famous Talmud of the Ramban. And the Rashba explains, in order to understand the background to the Gemara's entire account, we need to be aware of another statement of Chazal. And that's the way it goes sometimes. The words of Chazal, they're interlinked, right? They're intertwined, and sometimes you see one, but you don't get context unless you're aware of its sister comments. At the end of Parshas Chukas, the Torah says that Hashem said to Moshe, "Do not fear Og." And the Gemara says, "Well, that basically tells us that Moshe was afraid of Og, because you only tell a person not to be afraid when they're afraid." But why is Moshe afraid of Og? And Og is a giant, but still, Moshe knows that doesn't really make a difference. But the Gemara says, Moshe had cause to fear Og because Moshe knows that Og has a schus. He has a merit. Because Og is the one who came to tell Avram about the war, which led to that incredible situation, which was a nes, and it was a Kiddush Hashem, and all those things. And Og has a share in that. Now, two things we need to mention straight away. Firstly, the point is that people like Og, who do not really have much going for them after they leave this world in terms of reward for their mitzvahs, so their reward for their mitzvahs comes now. But a mitzvah is bigger than anything else in the world, which means even one mitzvah, if it gets cashed in, so to speak, in this world, the benefits can be enormous. And even though the mitzvah of Og, as Rashi himself tells us, what is Og's motivation in telling Avram to go to the war? His goal is not that Avram should go and sanctify God's name. His goal is that Avram should go to the war, get killed, and then he'll be able to marry Sarah. Now, there's a term for that. It's called shelo lishma. That is called ulterior motive, which means that the quality of his mitzvah is significantly lessened. And still Moshe is afraid, because even a lower grade mitzvah is still a force to be reckoned with. The other point that we need to mention is that if a rasha receives reward for a mitzvah in this world, it's very likely that he will not use it for more mitzvahs, because he's a rasha. In other words, the likelihood is that he did one good deed, but generally speaking, he doesn't really do good things. If he gets power or free, whatever it is, he's probably not going to use it for good things. We never find that it's, let's say, set up as a trust fund for him, in the sense as to say, listen, you got this from a mitzvah, so for the sake of good form, please be sure just to use this reward for further mitzvahs. No, he'll probably use them for averus, and he can. And in fact, we have a classic example of this from a little bit later on in history, where it really happened. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, in Perek Chelek, discusses Nebuchadnezzar, who, as we know, became the king of Babel, destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and the Gemara discusses the background to Nebuchadnezzar becoming the king of Babel. He was not originally the king. He was actually originally the secretary of the king. Except the king of Babel sent a letter to Chizkiah, I think it was, Melech Yehuda. There was some miracles that occurred then. He was very impressed, and he sent like a letter of peace. And the letter had read to the king of Israel and to the God of Israel. And the Gemara says that was Nebuchadnezzar's day off. But when he came back and he heard that was the nusach, he objected. And he says, you can't put the king of anyone before the God of anyone. God comes first and then the king. It was his one moment. And in fact, he actually began to pursue the runner who was delivering the letter, to call him back and order it correctly. He took three steps, says the Gemara, and then he stopped, or was stopped, actually. But the Gemara says that's all it took. In the merit of those three steps that he took, you know, in the honor of Hashem, he was awarded, he became the king of Babel. Except the, which once again, we see how incredible the returns, if a mitzvah is only converted into success in this world, the sky's the limit. Because the mitzvah is a completely different currency altogether. But what did he do as king of Babel, which he got as a result of giving honor to God? He didn't give more honor to God, he destroyed his temple. And because he's Nebuchadnezzar. Interestingly, those three steps they themselves reverberate for us. At the end of the Shemona Esrei, when we take three steps back, we daven for the restoration of the Beis HaMikdash. That is in, somehow, we're saying that the Nebuchadnezzar, for his three steps, he got the whole thing and he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So we're also giving honor to Hashem by not just walking away. You take three steps, you bow out, and that should counter, in the fullness of time, the damage of Nebuchadnezzar. But this is the background to Og. That's why Og is so dangerous, because he has this merit, and who knows how far it will take him. This, says the Rashba, is the background, and this is what the Gemara means when it says that he lifted up a mountain higher than his head that was equal in size to the rest of the Jewish people. A mountain is a way that the Navi refers to the Avos. The Navi Yeshaya says, Habitu el tsur chutzavtem bo, habitu el aharim, right? Look at the mountains that you're hewn from. The mountains, and Esayinai el aharim, again, me'ayin nebo ezri, the mountains refer to the Avos. when the Gemara says that Og picked up a mountain that was that big, what it meant was that he was now taking hold of his credit that he has by the Avos, right? The credit that he has by Avram, and it is equal potentially to the entire camp of Israel. He could damage all of them, and it's higher than his head because this merit is higher than he is. It's the greatest thing he ever did, and it's not typical for him. It's higher than he is. And thus we understand, says Rashba, how the Mishnah talks about the rock he sought to throw, while the Gemara talks about the mountain that he sought to throw. As if to say, he was a giant, he was capable of throwing large rocks, and they could cause a lot of damage. That means if you observed him physically, he'd be picking up these large rocks. And that's what you'll see today, if you can identify them. But so to speak, around the physical rock, we need to perceive a conceptual mountain, because where will his success come from in this campaign? From the mountain, his merit of Avram. But then when the Gemara says that Moshe comes, and Moshe, we have all these tens, and Moshe's 10 Amos, and the axe is 10 Amos, and he jumps 10 Amos, and what does all that mean? These are the counter merits. I mean, that's where the war is being fought. And the number 10 represents perfection, the number 10 represents a person's level, to be on level. Moshe is 10, that means Moshe has his own merits. Og has his merits. Moshe has his merits. And the axe represents the Jewish people. That's the tool that Moshe works with. And he jumps up 10 Amos. And in jumping up, that is to say, says Rashba, he jumps upwards and backwards. He's jumping also, he's looking to access from the past the merits of the Avos. Those three tens combined allowed Moshe to neutralize the merit of Og, even from accessing it in this world. And that is why the whole thing is summed up by saying that he delivered a death blow to Og's ankle. Because that's where Og's power is, because his merit is in his feet. Because by Avo HaPalit, he came to Avram, he ran from the war to tell him about it. And therefore, the idea of his ankle and of his heel, etc., it represents the merit that he has. Because Moshe was able to counter that, that is referred to as delivering that blow to the ankle, which was the end of Og. Even though if you saw the battle, you would not see Og falling down having been hit in the ankle, but you would have seen Og just simply losing the war, and he never knew why, because of these collective merits of Bnei Yisrael, Moshe, and our own Zchus Avos. So this really is a fascinating window, really, into so many things, but the nature of how these statements of Chazal, their depictions on many occasions, and it all begins with this pasuk Yud Gimel Vayavoa Palit Vayaged LaAvram Ivri. It would become such a contested issue later on, and around which all those things happened. So Og indeed comes to Avram. Avram goes to war, and he defeats those four kings. And now the king of Sodom emerges. Let's have a look at these psukim here. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Avram has been successful, and the pasuk Yud Zayin states by Yetzei Melech Sodom likroso, acharei shuvo miakosus katala omer. So the king of Sodom comes out to meet him. Obviously, he wants to talk with him, seeing as Avram basically has all of his possessions and all of his people. After he smote katala omer besamalachim asherito. Okay, so that's the king of Sodom. Next pasuk, umakit zedek melech shalem. Malkit zedek, the king of Shalem, who Masorah tells us is Shem ben Noach. Okay. Hotzi lechem v'yayin. He brought out bread and wine. He's a Kohen Lekel Elyon. Okay, so he's a king, he's a Kohen Lekel Elyon. He's lots of things. And he blesses Avram, v'yarechei v'yomar, baruch Avram Lekel Elyon, k'nei shamayim v'aretz. He blesses Avram, and then he blesses Hashem. Interesting, again, the order. V'baruch Kel Elyon, Hashem yigein tzarecha b'yadecha, baruch Hashem, who delivered your enemies into your hands. Vayiten lo maser mikol, he gave him maser, and we'll come back to that statement. What's next? The king of Sodom's famous bargain. Vayomer Melech Sodom al Avram, ten li ha-nefesh v'ruchush kachla. Give me the people, and you can keep all of the property. In the end, Avram doesn't want to take any of his property, the famous Michud Batzruchnal, which we'll get to soon. Why did we read all these psukim? Because it's very interesting to notice that we seem to shift topic and then come back to it, as if to say, Pasuk Yozayin introduces the king of Sodom, presumably because he's about to make this pitch to Avram, give me the people, you can keep all the property, which he does in Pasuk Kaf Aleph. But in the meanwhile, we have these three psukim, Yud Ches, Yud Tes, and Kaf, which is Malkit Tzedek, and we seem to just have it interrupted. The intuitive flow would have been by Yitzeh Melech Sodom, and he says to Avram, Tei Lenefesh, V'chush Kachlach. So it's quite unusual. It's just a short number of psukim, but nonetheless, I mean, it literally sounds like the parsha like broke for Kiddush. Because you got Sodom, and then we just interrupt, and we have some bread and some wine, and then we get back to what we were talking about. So why is it ordered in this way? It's a good shaina. And again, the Alshich, and this is his trademark, attention to detail, all of these things. The Alshich says, there's a parshanut point here. You see, the king of Sodom is prepared to make Avram an offer. If you give me the people, you can keep all the property. But when does someone like the king of Sodom, when is he ever prepared to offer anyone anything? If he feels that if he doesn't, he'll lose everything. But what if he might think that he could get everything? He'll never make an offer if he thinks that he doesn't have to offer anything. You see, what's interesting about the thinking here, the king of Sodom, he's very gracefully ran away during the war, but now he's back. And his entire holdings are with Avram. The people are in Avram's jurisdiction. His property is in Avram's jurisdiction. But the king of Sodom is thinking, okay, how am I going to get them back? What do I need to do to get them back? But the optimistic side of him is thinking, nothing. I don't have to give up anything to get them back because they're mine. And as much as Avram had this his reasons for going to war, and it's very nice, etc., but he is currently in possession. It wasn't his war. He intervened for personal reasons, and it's worked out very well for all of us, but it's not his war, which means that perhaps he doesn't see himself as being entitled to any of this. So why should I offer him anything? I'll just stand here, and if he's a mensch, he'll give it back. The king of Sodom will never make a bargain if he thinks that he can get everything without doing anything. That's the best bargain. And that's why it's a very interesting introduction. Pasuk Yud Zayin just says Vayetze Melech Sodom Lekroso. He came out to meet him. And as far as he's concerned, the most natural thing that should happen now is that Avram will say, well, here's everything back, and sorry for the trouble. And that's his expectation. But all of that changed. And it changed because of what happens next. His understanding of the situation underwent a transformation because Malkit Tzedek, firstly, so Malkit Tzedek greets Avram, and you see also the contrast. The king of Sodom, if he just saved your country, how come you don't make a kiddush for him? He just comes out with his hands open. Malkit Tzedek, who wasn't involved at all, but he knows these people have been at war, they've done a good thing, someone should give them refreshments. Okay, so be it. But then Malkit Tzedek begins to bless Avram, and one of the things he says is, Ubaruch Kel Elyon, blessed is Hashem Migain Sarecha Biadecha, who delivered your enemies into your hands. Which means before the king of Sodom's very eyes, this battle is being portrayed as between Avram and his enemies. He's no longer just an impartial or neutral intervener. But rather, it's become somehow Avram's battle against his enemies. Well, spoils of war says that if they're your enemies, then you keep whatever you took from them. It's already not looking so good for the king of Sodom. And moreover, the next thing that happens is, Vayiten lo maaser mikol, he gave him maaser. And the question is, Who gave whom Maaser? Avram gave Melchizedek Maaser. Melchizedek is a Kohen, for whatever that means in that context, right? But Avram recognizes that. And it's essentially the first thing a person does as they naturalize their newly acquired assets is to give Maaser to the Kohen. You don't do that if it's not yours and you're planning on giving everything back. But apparently Avram feels that that those that helped him are entitled to it. And this is at this point, the king of Sodom realizes he has to change his thinking. Because if he does nothing, he'll lose everything. And at the risk of losing everything, he's prepared to offer something. And that's why it's only now that the king of Sodom comes forward with his offer. He thinks that Avram will keep everything and everyone, but he at least wants his people back. And that's why it's Tenya Nefesh V'Rechush Kachlach. Once he says that, interestingly, he gets the Rechush back as well. Because Avram says, the way that you've phrased it is if you gave me the Rechush. That's actually not true. I got it in war that you were not involved in. But as soon as you've said it in that way, as Avram himself says, Lo tamar ani yashart yas Avram. I don't want you to say that you made Avram rich. And by the way, there's a very interesting comment. The one behind it eludes me just for a moment. But it's a very important insight. That Avram says, don't say that you made me rich. I don't want that to happen. Why not? Let the king of Sodom say that he made Avram rich. So what? He brags about everything. He brags about this. And what difference does it make at the end of the day? But it makes a difference. Because not only is it not true, but in a sense, it impugns the worth of everything Avram's doing. Because really, when the king of Sodom is saying, listen, you know, the world needs Avrams. And I'm not an Avram. But the world also needs people like me who know how to make money in whatever way they can. And because Avram can only really operate if there's people like me who are behind him. I'm the one that made Avram rich. He needs to be rich, right? Because he needs to do what he needs to do. He needs funders, and I'm his funder. And therefore, it's almost like it sanitizes the methods of the king of Sodom, because he's saying, where would someone like Avram be without me? But to draw the roots of Avram's activities back to the sullied enterprises of Sodom, that's something that Avram is not prepared to do. And at that point, he gives everything back. But that is the analysis. It's such a simple question. If we note, we go from Sodom, the king of Sodom, and then to Melchizedek, and then back to king of Sodom. It's because of what happened with Melchizedek that led things out in that conversation with the king of Sodom. Interestingly, once again, certainly in Chumash Bereishis, the interplay and the relationship between the narratives of what's happening and our history, but halacha comes in there once in a while, and mitzvahs come in there once in a while, and seeds are sown for mitzvahs, even if those mitzvahs aren't given straight away. They won't be given till Har Sinai. And an example of such a thing is Avram's the result of Avram's famous words, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Im Michut Vat Tzrochnal, I won't take not a chut and not Tzrochnal, which is a very interesting way of phrasing things, actually, because a chut is a thread and a Tzrochnal is a shoelace, and they hardly represent two extremes of anything, because they're both very near to each other on the same extreme of almost nothing. So it's hardly to say from the greatest to the smallest. They're both two types of smallest. And there's almost nothing in between them. Okay, but in any case, the Gemara in Maseches Sota comments that in the merit of Avram saying in Michut Vatzruchnal, which was such a thing to say, it's such a pure response. Not surprisingly, he's Avram Avinu, but nonetheless, full merit that in reward for saying in Michut. His descendants were merited chut shel tcheles, right? They got the tcheles and the tzitzis. And in the reward for saying ba'atzrochnal, his descendants got the mitzvah of tefillin, again, which is with those straps. Now, okay. All these statements of Chazal really do need to be pondered, of course, because what does that mean to say, had Avram not said michut ba'atzrochnal? But nonetheless, these are the forces that lead to the catalyst, so to speak, that lead to those mitzvahs coming to Bnei Yisrael. Interestingly, we have already met, at least with regards to the mitzvah of tzitzis, we have already met the background, the historical background, so to speak, the merit background. in Parshas Noah. Because as we know, that the episode is after the flood, where Noah, he's lying there, unclothed in his tent, and Shem and Yefes, they cover him over. In Perek Tes, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Vayikach Shem vayefes es asimla. So Shem and Yefes, they take this sheet. Vayasima Shem Shehem, they put it on their shoulders. Vayachucharonis, it's very bechavadik. Cham is dafka looking to remove the kovet. He doesn't want to have a relationship of respect between him and Noach. That could be inhibitive for him, and therefore he's happy to find Noach in a disgraced state. It frees him in a sense, which is why he became a slave as a result of the of taking advantage of that. But Shem and Yefes, they walk backwards. It's becovered. And they cover him over, it's all very circumspect. Rashi comments that although there's two people involved, the pasuk says vayikach, which is in the singular, which means that one of them is principally involved. That's Shem. Limit al Shem. Shem is mentioned first, and he was the main protagonist here. Shem is ametz b'mitzvah, yoseh miyefes. He put himself out to do this mitzvah. Lakach zachu bonav l'talish al titzis. And therefore, in that merit, his descendants, they got tzitzis, which is us. So it's an interesting situation, because the question now is, well, who is the personality behind the mitzvah of tzitzis coming into the world? Is it Shem, as per Parshas Noach, or is it Avram, as per our Parsha? Now perhaps the simplest answer, even though this is not a simple matter at all, is that perhaps it's very simply collaborative. As if to say, the extent to which you need some type of positive act to bring this into the world, perhaps you need more than one positive act. Maybe you need both catalysts. So Shem began the process of bringing it into the world, and then Avram completed it. And therefore, it's not a contradiction. They're not in conflict. They're in corroboration with each other. And in fact, that idea would seem to be borne out very simply by the fact that no other descendants of Shem have a mitzvah of tzitzis except for the Jewish people. So, but why not? I mean, if according to that Rashi, what about he has many descendants, as we know? But the point is, it was a two-stage process, and you need to have both stages in order for the process to be complete. He began it, but only Avram completed it. And that's why, of all the descendants of Shem, from that whole pool, only the descendants of Avram ended up with the mitzvah of tzitzis. That is the approach, actually, of Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz. It's a Rosh Hashiva approach. Interestingly, the Mizrahi, Rabbeinu Eliyahu Mizrahi, he actually takes a rather different approach, for he sees that there's room within the mitzvah to divide different parts of it and ascribe one to Shem and one to Avram. After all, says the Mizrahi, don't forget that the Gemara is very specific. The Gemara says that in reward for Avram saying, in michut, from a thread, his descendants were zocha to chut shel tcheles. The thread of Tcheles. Now, as we know, tzitzis are made up of more than the thread of Tcheles. Tcheles, in a sense, takes them to a new level, and it's a specific element within the mitzvah of tzitzis, but it's not the totality of the mitzvah of tzitzis. And therefore, says the Mizrahi, it may well be to make shalom, so to speak, between the two statements, is that as a result of Shem's act, we got the mitzvah of tzitzis generally, and then with the further act of Avram gave us a further element within the mitzvah of tzitzis, namely chut shel tcheles. Interestingly, as we see, that approach is quite different. The mitzvah is almost divided up in its component parts. A similar approach to the Mizrahi is given by actually a contemporary Talmud Chacham. His name was Rav Shalom Schechter, and he has a sefer called Darchei Shalom, and we'll see, it goes parallel to what the Mizrahi is saying. And he asks an interesting shaila, and as is his way, he prefaces with the following question. When it comes, for example, to, if we would compare the mitzvah, shall we say, of tefillin to the mitzvah of mezuzah, they're very close to each other, both in parchment. The parchment of tefillin is housed somewhere, and the parchment of mezuzah is housed somewhere. Where? The parchment of tefillin is in the batim, what we of the tefillin themselves. Where is the parchment of mezuzah? It's on the doorpost. So each have their setting. The setting of the scroll of mezuzah, of tefillin is the bias of the tefillin. The setting of the scroll of mezuzah is the person's house. Okay. As we can appreciate, those two settings are not the same. The bias of the tefillin is part of the mitzvah. It's part of the... You can't have it without it. And it has also its own kedusha. A person's house is not part of the mitzvah of mezuzah. It doesn't have the kedusha like a bias of tefillin, even though you put the mezuzah on it. It's very interesting. It is purely the setting for the mitzvah, but the mitzvah is only the scroll of the mezuzah. Again, just to be clear, when it comes to tefillin, the scroll of the mezuzah is not, of tefillin, is not the subtotal of the mitzvah. The setting that encompasses it is also part of the mitzvah. Not so in mezuzah. The only item of mitzvah is mezuzah. The house, purely the setting. Okay. That leads us to an interesting shaila. What about tzitzis? The thread of tzitzis is attached to the four-cornered garment. No garment, no thread. The thread, of course, is the mitzvah. But what about the garment itself? Is that also part of the mitzvah? As if to say, do we look upon the relationship of the garment to the threads like a house to a mezuzah? It's just there to attach the threads to it, just like the house is there to affix the mezuzah to it, but it's not really part of the mitzvah, it's just the setting for the mitzvah. Or do we say, no, the garment actually, it's like the tefillin. It houses the tzitzis and it's also part of the mitzvah. And should we ask, well, what difference does it make? At the end of the day, practically, it's the same. But it might make a difference. Because there is a concept called beautifying mitzvahs. Now, when there's a mitzvah to beautify mitzvahs, hidur mitzvah. But you only really need to beautify the mitzvah itself, not its setting, which means in our two clear cases, we understand it's not the same. Because the whole, all of tefillin is part of the mitzvah, there's a mitzvah to beautify all of tefillin. You should have nice batim, because it's part of the mitzvah. There is no mitzvah, rumors to the contrary notwithstanding, there is no mitzvah to have a beautiful house as a hidur for the mitzvah of mezuzah, even though the mezuzah is attached to the house. Yes, it is, but the mitzvah is mezuzah, not the house. If you want to have a nice house, you can for other reasons, but not as a hidur for the mitzvah of mezuzah. Ah, so now there is a practical difference when it comes to the question of the talis, of the actual garment to which the tzitzis are attached. If it's part of the mitzvah, then there'll be a mitzvah to have a nice talis, because it's like having nice tefillin. But if it's just a setting for the mitzvah, then maybe there's a mitzvah to have nice threads, but it doesn't translate into the garment, because that's like the house. So who will answer this question for us? Rashi will. Rashi, in Maseches Baba Kama and Daf Tes, who gives us a brief description of Hidur Mitzvah. The source is Zekei Liva Anbehu, as we know. This is my God, I will glorify him, meaning I will glorify him through his mitzvahs. It says, Rashi, hisna elefan of b'mitzvahs. Glorify his mitzvahs. And Rashi gives examples. Aseilecha, make for example, Sefer Torah na'a, a nice Sefer Torah. Lulav na'a, which we just came out of. Talis na'a v'tzitzis na'a, a nice talis. And nice tzitzis. Those are Rashi's examples. Says Rav Shalom Shechter. That's very interesting. Rashi has included within the category of Hidur Mitzvah also the talis, not just the strings. That's Rashi's way of telling us that the talis is also part of the mitzvah, because Hidur Mitzvah only accrues to the object of mitzvah. So now we've discovered that the mitzvah of tzitzis has two components, the threads and the garment. Says Rav Shechter, go back now to the two statements of Chazal. On the one hand, we see the mitzvah of tzitzis is attributed already to shame. But on the other hand, we see that it's attributed, so to speak, to Avram. How can it be? Says the Darkei Shomer. What were they talking about? Or what were they involved in? Shame got his mitzvah because he took that sheet and put it over Noah. Right? So therefore, his interaction was with a garment. And that's why Rashi specifies and says his descendants were zocher to talis shel mitzvah. It's the garment that Shem provided with his act. Whereas Avram is speaking about chutim. And that's how the mitzvah is thus divided. Similar in approach to the Mizrahi, but unlike between the tcheles and the rest, it's between the strings and the garment, to each what he was involved in or what he spoke about. So that's very interesting to see how even until our times, these discussions continue with new insights. Well, let's conclude our discussion this evening by referring to a well-known question. And in fact, it's two questions that relate to the Bris Ben Habesorim, which is when Avram is foretold about what will happen to his descendants. Let's see those psukim in Perek Tes Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Perek Tes Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer la'Avram, Hashem says to Avram, we've landed ourselves right in the middle of the Bris Ben Habesorim, between the pieces of the Bris Ben Habesorim. You should know well that your descendants, they will be strangers. They will serve them. They will persecute them. The pronouns are shifting. For 400 years. But that nation that they serve, I will judge them. Meaning in a very critical way, and they will receive retribution, which, as we know, they did. And now the question is, why? Why were the Egyptians punished? And there are two questions here, and it's important to identify them as two questions. One is raised by the Rambam, and the other by the Ramban. The Rambam, in Hilchos Tshuva, which is where he discusses the concept of free will, which is itself interesting, actually, as Mefarshim pointed out, the Rambam has a section in Mishnah Torah called Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the foundations of Torah. And he doesn't talk about the idea of free will there, even though, as far as the Rambam is concerned, it is as foundational as it gets. But he actually leaves it until Hilchos Tshuva, which is, and then he begins to talk about it. And that's its own discussion. But in any case, in Perek Vav of Hilchos Tshuva, in Halacha Hei, the Rambam asks the question, how is it possible to punish the Egyptians when it has already been foretold that they will persecute the Jewish people? And to explain the background to his question, because it seems to be seemingly another iteration of the question, if everything is known to Hashem before it happens, so then people can't really choose. And if they can't choose, they shouldn't be accountable for their actions. Says Rambam, it's not that question. It's worse here. And the reason why is because at the end of the day, when we talk about Hashem's knowledge, we don't know what it means for Hashem to know something. We don't understand that about him or about his knowledge. Which means of the two ideas that we're looking to see in conflict with each other, we can't, because we don't understand one of them, and therefore you can't in any meaningful way say that this contradicts the other idea. You don't really understand this idea in the first place. Which means that within the mysterious and unknowable realm of what it means for Hashem to know something, let's say that's a moot question now. We don't know what it means, that, and therefore it doesn't preclude a person being able to choose. Here it's different, says Rambam. Because it wasn't just something that Hashem knew, it's something that Hashem had already now communicated to a person, to Avram. And therefore it is known in the way that we know what it means to know something. Avram knows this will happen. Once it's been expressed in that temporal way, so now the question comes back, because it is known. But if it's known, then can they not do it? And if they don't have a choice, so how can they be punished? The Rambam's famous response to this question is that the knowledge was about the nation in general, but each individual within that nation can yet choose, is he going to be one of those who will be part of this national persecution? Not everyone needs to. Each individual can opt out, and therefore he is yet culpable. Which is itself a very interesting answer. It sounds like, in principle, it would have been impossible for all of the Egyptian nation, even as individuals, to opt out, because then there'll be no one left. But it has been foretold that it will happen. But that's not the cheshbon of each individual person. That, in brief, is Rambam's question. So again, the question was about what we call yediyah and bechira, foreknowledge, free knowledge, determination, free will, etc., and that is his response. The Ramban has a different question here. As if to say, as far as Ramban is concerned, the question still exists. And the reason why is because the Ramban says not only do we have Hashem has expressed knowledge of what will happen, but he seems to have expressed a directive of what should happen. In other words, this is part of Hashem's plan for the Jewish people, that there is a nation that will persecute them. Well, if that's the case, then whatever nation does so is fulfilling Hashem's will. If they're fulfilling Hashem's will, why are they punished for doing that? So if we're clear how it's not the same question, because Rambam is saying that a person, each individual could have gotten out of it, and therefore if he's in it, he's culpable. Says Rambam, he should be in it. It's a mitzvah. It's God's will. That's what a mitzvah is. And therefore, we shouldn't be looking to see how everyone could have gotten out of it. Let them all be in it, and why should they be punished? They're doing a good thing. The point of conflict here, of dispute here, is that the Rambam doesn't see this as a mitzvah. As much as it's a foretelling, he doesn't see this. Not every time Hashem foretells something, does that mean that he approves of the thing that he's foretelling? Hashem foretells Moshe that after he dies, the Jewish people will go to idol worship. That doesn't mean he approves. And therefore, the Rambam doesn't recognize the Ramban's question. That's how the Meshech Chochma and others explain. He doesn't recognize Ramban's question, because the fact that Hashem said that it will happen doesn't mean that he wants it to happen, and that it represents an expression of his actual will, to the extent that a person who does it will be doing a mitzvah. They're doing an aveira. It's called terrorizing and persecuting an innocent nation, as far as they're concerned. But for Ramban, you see such a difference in vision here. But for Ramban, it's a mitzvah, but how can you be punished for doing a mitzvah? Says Ramban, there are two ways. And he quotes support from Sukkim in Nach for both of them. Firstly, says Ramban, even persecution, as part of Hashem's plans, has limits, has boundaries, and if the nation should exceed the boundaries, then they will be punished for exceeding the boundaries. As if to say, just to say that backwards, Ramban is saying, had they only stayed within their mandate, they would not have been punished, and if one could even say such a thing, they would have been rewarded, because they're doing a mitzvah, but they took it too far. And anything that's beyond the boundaries of the Brisbane Abisarim is absolute crime. And that's why Hashem says, Vegames hagoya she'avodu, the nation that your descendants serve, don anochi, I'll judge them. We take judgment in the sense, terms of meeting out judgment, meaning we're already at the point of punishing. But Hashem says, no, I won't necessarily punish them. I will judge them. We'll see. But what's the nature of the judgment? Did they stay within their mandate or not? If no, then they'll be punished. And that's why the punishments typically that accrued to the Egyptians were in areas where they were excessive. And no more so than drowning in the Yam Suf, because they tried to drown the Jewish newborn males. And that's not called persecution. That's called eradication. And that's why Yisro, when he hears about the whole thing, he says, I see it the way Hashem worked. Kiva dovar asher zodu aleihim, in the way that they were wanton, in the way that they were excessive. Those are the areas that they were punished. So that is answer number one of Ramban. The judgment will be, have they exceeded their mandate? And he quotes a pasuk in Zechariah, in Perek Aleph, pasuk Tesvav, and Zechariah says about all the nations that are persecuting the Jewish people, Ani katsavti lara, vehem ozru harbe, ehem kotsu harbe. In other words, I called upon them, and they're the instruments of my wrath. But they got angrier than I did. I was a little angry with the Jewish people. They got very angry. Angrier than me. They're no longer serving as my emissaries. And that's why they'll be punished. That's corroboration of Ramban's first approach. The second approach, briefly, although of course it's all this deserves much more time, is it's a question of intent, says Ramban. If you have such a delicate issue, namely, persecuting a nation in fulfillment of Hashem's will and calling that a mitzvah, one thing is for sure, intent matters. As if to say, why are you doing it? Because you like persecuting people? Because you wish to perform Hashem's will. In this instance, and again he quotes a pasuk in Yeshaya, Perek Yud, talking about Sancheriv, Melech Ashur, who was punished. And why was he punished? Because Hashem says famously, Hoy Ashur Shevet Api, Ashur is the rod of my wrath. But then the next pasuk says, "V'hu lo chen yidmeh." But he doesn't look at things that way, and that's why he'll be punished. He doesn't see himself as fulfilling Hashem's will. He sees himself as expanding his borders and crushing everyone who gets in his way. it's one thing to call this a mitzvah, but if you don't even have intent for a mitzvah, so then it's just then becomes an act. And according to this approach, the don anochi, the judgment, will be inside of them. To what degree were they really l'shem shamayim? To what degree was this in fulfillment of God's will, or just in fulfillment of Egypt's will, with all that goes with that? And that is his second explanation as to why it was they were punished. And that's a newer understanding, as we said, of don anochi. Don anochi doesn't just mean they're obviously in the wrong, I'll just punish them, but rather I'll judge them to see in what way they're in the wrong as the events unfold later on in the Chumash. We'll leave it over there.